number of amateurs who are, for whatever reason, unable to sign into the TechNet, and particularly if they're a beginning person that doesn't have his license yet, and he asks Mel a question, we do our best to answer questions like that. Our main purpose is to do a live, let me call it broadcast, narrowcast, a live program in which people sign in and verbally, immediately, at 150 words a minute of conversation, if we get excited, they get some kind of an answer. The price is right. We are not offering a free written consulting service. That was not the original intent of this net. I run a consulting business. Mel has run a consulting business, and people pay us for our skills in the real world, if you know what I mean. In the world of ham radio, we enjoy this, and we do it more for fun than anything else, as long as it's live. I'm an extremely slow typer, so to answer people in writing, quite often a person will pose a question to you, and it sounds very logical. He asks A, you answer what you think is A, and then he says, no, that's not what I meant. And it just goes back and forth. In the case of verbal interchange, live, we find out real fast that we're off target on what he was really asking, and we find out real fast which way to go, and therefore you see some of the reason why we try to do it live and real. For those who want to listen to past TechNets, let me drop. There is a beautiful TechNet. There is a recording of the last few years of TechNets with documentation as to what subject in general is discussed during each period. And you can find that by going to www.amateurradio.tv. Amateurradio.tangovictor is the website for the TechNet. And a few other recordings that Mike Perry does, KC2NJI, a heroic effort by my standards. For once in a while, like I believe roughly 1 week ago, 2 weeks ago, the recording becomes erroneous, where you may not be able to download and hear that particular chunk of audio. And that condition usually exists for a short period of time until Mike finds out about it and makes a correction. So I think 1 week or 2 weeks ago, there is one whole session of the TechNet, which at least on the machine I've got at work and the machine I've got at home, it refuses to play that particular audio for that particular week. But others before and after it do play. And as I said, that does get corrected. You'll also discover that there are certain given subjects which keep recurring frequently, like how do decibels work or how does the Smith chart work. And you'll find that what Mike has done is to take the mini lectures given by Mel and Dick on that particular subject, assemble them all in one place, and therefore if you want to know more about that particular subject, you play that particular set of programs, and you'll hear the material. So the price is right. I've been hearing tell that certain colleges, particularly in the New Jersey area, professors are telling their students that if you want to know more about electronics, I'll listen to these set of recordings or listen to this particular set of programs. It's sort of an honor. Okay. Once again, as I said, if you want to sign into the TechNet, please give me your call letters and name at this time, and that word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW, and we're listening.
W-A-2-R-A-S, Jeff, yes.
Okay, that was a triple, but we got W-A-2-R-A-S was the loudest one, Jeff, and he's number one. Who else was signing in?
W-A-2-Q-G-Z, Bill, and yeah.
Leo, Dick, good evening, no questions.
Okay, Bill, W2QGZ, WB2, I think it is QGZ. I bet you he's going to be talking about crystal detectors. And Rich, we got you. And by the way, that's a darn good subject. Bill and I have had a mini session earlier in the week in which we found out that an extremely useful tool, which is not well described in any of the books that I know about, not well taught in the schools. It's a poor man's power meter. It's a beautiful way of finding out what your modulation is like. A crystal detector is one of the subjects. Will be our second subject tonight after Jeff, which Bill and I and the group will be discussing. And I think you'll find that one to be quite educational. Okay, so far we've got Joe, Jeff, Bill, and Rich. Anyone else like to sign in? Please give me your call letters and name at this time.
This is Kilo Charlie 2, Tango Delta Lima, with a question.
K2KEY.
KC2MDP, Steve, no questions.
KC2DEP, Charlie, no questions.
Okay, we got
yes.
We got Charlie, Steve, Mel, Joe, TDL. Mr. KC2TDL, what is your name, sir? Joe, we're hearing your rodeo in the background. Apparently your mic is stuck.
KC2TDL?
No, it's not.
Okay, yeah. Mr. TDL, what is your name, sir?
Yes, this is John, KC2TDL.
Very fine, John. Okay, so have I skipped anyone so far? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
And to GOT Howard, no questions.
Okay, we got Howard. Anyone else?
Internet.
Okay, the first person who signed in, to my knowledge, with a real question is Jeff, to VA2RAS. What would you like to discuss, Jeff? K2RIW.
Okay, thank you, Dick. K2RAW, WA2RAS. Well, I had a rather, I thought, bizarre situation here about 2 weeks ago, which I thought might be applicable to ham radio, even though it wasn't a ham radio situation. What was happening was, briefly, my cable TV picture was being pixelated severely. Not all channels, but many channels, especially the movie channels, were unwatchable for, let's say, 45 out of 60 seconds. So it was only not pixelated for 15 out of 60 seconds. Severe problem. Called the cable company, thinking that the problem was the reception of the signal from the satellite to the cable TV company, because if there was a problem with my set, it would have been on all channels, not just some channels. But as I say, it was severe. Anyway, after letting it go for quite a while, I called the cable company, came, and here's the kicker. It wasn't a problem with the signal. It was a problem with the squirrel. There were squirrels, or squirrels, gnawing away at the cable wire itself. I mention this because that never occurred to me as a problem. I didn't know that rodents had a taste for cable. But that being the case, I wonder if that, happens to coax cable. Well, this was coax cable, actually, and could easily happen to my ham radio antenna. I've got coax coming out of my ears here. K2RAW, WA2RAS.
Jeff, heard, Jeff, people not being able to get the bugs out of the system. In your case, you got to get the squirrels out. I'm going to make a guess that portions of the signal coming down your cable going into your converter box, if you're using a converter box, which then goes into your particular television set, is a digital signal. And as Eric, KE2EJ, has brought to our attention on many occasions, the good news about a digitalized television signal is that when all is well, you get a beautiful snow-free picture with essentially no artifacts or whatever, per se. However, digital television has an extremely abrupt threshold characteristic. In the case of analog television, old-fashioned television, as the signal got weaker and weaker because your antenna deteriorated or you aimed in the wrong direction or the trees in front of your antenna got wet with rain, more attenuation took place, as the signal got weaker, you just saw more and more snow on the screen. And the picture became watchable for probably 20 decibels of change in signal-to-noise ratio, maybe even 30 in some cases. Whereas with digital television, you could be watching a perfectly displayed picture, and as the signal getting into the digital converter box becomes weaker, all of a sudden it starts becoming pixelated, the sound becomes interrupted, and pretty soon you have nothing. The difference between a perfect picture and nothing is a fraction of one decibel. In other words, you could say you go from the 85% point to the 80% point in signal strength, and all of a sudden the picture is no longer meeting the characteristics where the digital converter circuitry can make sense out of it, and it gives up. on many of our digital converter boxes, when you go to the right mode, have a kind of a signal strength indicator, a bar graph or a number or whatever. Sometimes it's a red, orange, and green bar graph, and you'd like to believe that that's displaying signal strength. In most cases, it's displaying bit error rate. In my particular case, for instance, tonight when I wanted to watch 60 Minutes, I was getting periodic interruptions because the channel that 60 Minutes is on, which calls itself
repeater, timeout.
That channel calls itself CBS and Channel 2, but I think it's really UHF Channel 33, if I remember correctly, or 28. Anyhow, a identical frequency channel also exists at Hartford, Connecticut. My land is 300 feet above sea level. My television aerial mounted on the chimney of the house at times picks up both signals simultaneously, and they beat against each other, and the co-channel interference doesn't have to be very strong before my digital converter box says no way. So I have to put up a higher directive antenna with a rotator. And that's one of the experiments that Eric has discovered some time ago, that it's not just pure signal strength. It's whether or not the signal is bouncing off of a local water tower or whether or not there's co-channel interference. As such, using the right external antenna, preferably with a rotator, will often give you a lot of improvement in performance. Now, you're one of the smarter guys, Jeff, where you're using real cable TV. I'm one of the real cheap guys who insists on over-the-air broadcast, and I don't own cable television, so some of what you're describing I haven't seen. However, it fits the characteristics of pixelation. What you're discovering is that underground wiring, let me drop, has a lot of desirable characteristics as far as aesthetic appeal to the neighborhood. However, underground wiring is notoriously more expensive and lower in reliability. There's a zillion ways that the rodents, worms, bugs, water, whatever, can get into the underground wiring, whether it be for reasons of power or signal or whatever, and it can give you trouble. So that's what I think you've run into. Let me pass it back to you, Jeff. Drag your feet a little bit in case some of the smarter people who know more about broadcast and cable TV have a couple of comments that they would like to add. W2RAS with a delay, K2RAW in the tech man. Looks like there's no one else with a comment. You got it, Jeff.
Thanks, Dick. Well, you hit it right on the head. You know, it is a digital signal, and that's what was happening. In other words, the strength of the right away the technicians realized that the strength was of the signal was not what it should be, and then the problem came to find out why that was, and you know, and then it turned out the culprit was a squirrel looking for some kind of dental floss. It's just that I hadn't heard that problem before, and I just didn't know whether this was limited to cable, rodents or other animals looking for something to gnaw on or eat. It was limited to just the cable wires, or they could go after coax, and it is and unfortunately not buried, or maybe fortunately, it's going through the telephone across the from telephone pole to telephone pole, and then then to the house. But they were eating my wires. Back to you, Dick. W2RAS.
M2EO, Dick.
Rich recognized, but let me get back to Jeff for a second. Jeff, you being a curious type amateur, when they came to your house to investigate the situation, most likely you watched the technician. I'm curious what he did. I think you're saying that the actual elevated wiring up on the utility poles themselves, maybe it's the drop wire that goes to your house or the actual trunk cable going between the individual utility poles. What did you see? How did that technician find it? And how did he make the splice? How did he make the repair? Tell me what you observed, Jeff, because You've got a rather unique situation that we'd like to hear about it. You got it, Jeff.
Got to be honest with you. I did not see where the where they replaced the cable. I had the impression, which could be wrong, that it was the drop wire, running from the pole to the house and possibly some of the drop wire. Yeah, obviously it it splits it comes to the house and then goes every which way to different rooms which have have multiple sets. So yeah, I believe it was more than one wire. It was a lengthy repair, but I can't swear that it wasn't the trunk line. But I would think that there would have been holy heck because they, other people might have been affected in that case. Dick, back to you.
I think what we've learned so far, Jeff, is that the squirrels in Island Park, New York, where you live, are a pretty aggressive crowd. Potent animals. Look out for them. Let's see what Rich has got to say about all this. I wonder if you ever run into anything like this or heard anything like this one, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, N2EO. I know it's a big problem for the phone company. A telephone man told me once, because he got wires run in the backyard. The squirrels walk on the wires and they eat the wires. And I remember we were talking last night about years ago when I worked for Western Union on telex equipment. We had the same trouble in Manhattan with rats under the street eating. They like the PVC, something that rodents like.
Yeah, I think they eat things out of curiosity. The PVC itself, I don't think, supplies much nourishment to them. But they probably think it's an outer shell of something that once they eat through it, there's something more desirable inside. Squirrels and, mostly squirrels are very curious animals. I had a 3,500-pound antenna positioner made by the Scientific Atlanta Company in my backyard for a number of years before I sold it to a man in Virginia. I was going to use this for a radio telescope project of mine in the backyard. And there was a 3/4-inch diameter bolt hole where a bolt had been removed on the case, and squirrel-like animals, some kind of a rodent, crawled through that 3/4-inch hole, created a nest inside. His whole brood of nest went through their maturation process, obvious by all of the detritus they left and all of the fur and the nesting and whatever, all this kind of material left on the inside of my housing. How in the world the adult squirrels and the brood, the offspring, managed to squeeze in and out of a 3/4-inch diameter bolt hole is just beyond me. I'm having a lot of trouble envisioning how they did that, but my goodness, do they do it. Very aggressive animals, and they created a fair amount of damage, believe it or not. The guano they left created quite a bit of erosion of the cast iron of this particular great big positioner of mine with all kinds of gears and cells and motors and whatever on the inside. I guess they didn't create a whole lot of damage, but it was more than an annoyance, if you know what I mean. So you got to worry about those guys. Okay, let's go to the next person. Bill, what would you like to talk about? I'll talk about anything except crystal detectors. I'm having some fun with you, Bill. Give us a couple of quick words as to how you first came upon these subjects, and I wonder if you see it the same way as I do, Bill. It's a subject that has been poorly covered in the past. I think Mel and I are probably going to have a little mini lecture on this particular subject because it's an extremely useful tool that you sometimes can buy rather inexpensively at a flea market. And even if you get a defective one, there's a lot of advantage in buying one of these things. So how did you first hear about them? And have you also discovered, like I did, that they are not well covered in the books and lectures that you and I have been exposed to?
Repeater, time out.
They're not well covered in the books and lectures that you and I have been exposed to up to now. W-A-2-Q-G-Z, KQLIW.
All right, WB2QG said. Yep, well, that's it. I ran into it, some discussion on the microwave reflector, and just developed a couple of questions from the posts, some of which we talked about specifically. In other words, how do I make the output useful to me, and what do I have to keep in mind when looking at the output? And I did not find a whole lot else looking around online or in the handful of books I have over here, other than a basic description, pretty much. So, you know, what I was kind of hoping or looking forward to was that I could unleash you and Mel on the topic and then just sit back and, you know, absorb. That's pretty much it.
Good subject. So once again, there's a whole series of crystal detectors made by Hewlett-Packard and many other companies, but Hewlett-Packard is one of the popular ones. And what does a crystal detector do? Why do you desire to have one? Why is it so good? I mean, these are the kind of questions a guy could ask. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of my association with them. Let's first discover an RF wave, discuss an RF wave. A crystal detector, by the way, is primarily used with radio frequency signals in order to make measurements on them. An RF wave, by definition, is a alternating current. That is to say, if you look down an oscilloscope at the signal that Con Ed and LIPA, the New Jersey and Power and Light, supplies to you, it would be a sine wave on your oscilloscope, where the sine wave spends half of its time positive and half of its time negative. It's got an average voltage of zero, but it is an alternating signal of a sine wave nature. Take that 60-cycle wave that's at the socket of the power cord to all of your equipment in your house, raise it high enough in frequency, like 3.5 megacycles, 7 megacycles, and so on, 50 megacycles, 146.85 megacycles, and you have an RF wave, which is identical to that sine wave that powers your refrigerator. It's just higher in frequency. However, it spends half of its time positive and negative. It is a neutral voltage on average, but it has a certain heating value called RMS value. And so if you just took that voltage and applied it to your digital sensing DC voltmeter, it would show nothing. If you put it to the AC scale of your digital voltmeter, most likely it wouldn't register properly, because the AC scale on a DVM rarely goes beyond 100 KC, maybe 1 megacycle in response, and you're trying to measure a 14 megacycle or 146 megacycle signal. So to measure it directly as an AC signal with simple instrumentation represents a problem. Okay, along comes a crystal detector. Let me drop. And in the early days, I didn't have access to a crystal detector, but I was able to get from Lafayette Electronics or wherever a 1N34 diode, and I made my own crystal detector. 1N34 diode in series with the signal you want to measure. You measure. On the far side of it, you have a capacitor to ground, and of course that capacitor is a resistor. And you measure the voltage drop that's developed in that capacitor from the diode. The diode is acting as a rectifier. In other words, it takes the, depending on which direction you set up the diode, it takes the positive half of the sine wave, and the diode conducts, charges the capacitor. The negative half of the sine wave, the diode is not responding to, so it does nothing. Then the bottom line of all this is that the crystal detector will, in general, charge that capacitor to a voltage value equal to the peak of the RF voltage, minus a little voltage drop of the diode, but it is showing you the upper envelope of the RF wave. If the RF wave is amplitude modulated, then what comes out of the crystal detector is the outer envelope as a video signal. So with a crystal detector that quite often you can buy at a flea market, the RF input is quite often an SMA connector or a type N connector, usually male. The output side, in the case of the type N connector, Hewlett-Packard crystal detector, is usually a BNC. The video output is a BNC. And you take that BNC output, and now you can do two or three things with it. The friendliest thing you can do with it is connect it directly with a 50-ohm BNC to BNC coaxial cable into the front panel of an oscilloscope. And now, how do you set the oscilloscope? some of the better high-frequency oscilloscopes have a bunch of buttons on the front panel in which you can determine how the external connector is internally connected to the oscilloscope. Let me drop. You can make the oscilloscope directly connected, AC connected, or 50 ohm loaded. If you punch the button on the front panel of a fast oscilloscope so that the oscilloscope presents a 50 ohm load, in that case you will get the fastest possible video response out of the crystal detector. You could use the crystal detector on, say, for instance, looking at a square wave modulated RF signal, like if you're transmitting amplitude modulated digital signals with an RF transmitter. With that crystal detector, you would be looking at the video waveform, which is the outer envelope of that square wave of modulated RF, and you'd be able to measure the rise time to the nearest 5 nanoseconds. Crystal detectors loaded with 50 ohms are very fast. Or even if it's a very slow modulated signal, you'd see that on the oscilloscope also, fast or slow. On top of that, the crystal detector usually is a very deterministic device. It's got a transfer characteristic that is rather well documented. If you go to the right Hewlett-Packard or Agilent website where they give you application notes. And so the RF input magnitude versus the video output video voltage or DC voltage is a known transfer curve. Therefore, it is a kind of absolute power indicator, and it is an instantaneous absolute power indicator. If, for instance, you're putting out single sideband signals and you want to know what is the true peak envelope power, a crystal detector properly calibrated will show you that with very high accuracy. The crystal detector itself has a kind of a peculiar transfer characteristic, and not many people know this, but for weak signals, it has a square law characteristic. When you look at the data sheet from Hewlett-Packard on the crystal detector that was on the microwave reflector over the last week, I'm trying to remember the model number, and maybe Bill will repeat that model number for me. It was a fairly popular one. I think one of them was HP number 423, something like that, 423B. Is one of the model numbers. There's a whole lot of other model numbers. Some of these crystal detectors, by the way, work 10 megacycle to 18 gigahertz inclusive. They present a 50 ohm load on the RF end. They are operatable over that frequency range, 10 megacycles to 18 gigahertz. Requires no tuning of any kind. It's an extremely broadband, fast-acting device. And for weak signals like minus 30 dBm, they have a square law characteristic. And the Hewlett-Packard application note will tell you that each microwatt of input will give you 1 millivolt of output, you know, something like that. It has a direct characteristic of power in versus millivolt output up to a certain power level, which is around minus 20 dBm. Minus 20 dBm is around 10 microwatts. Beyond 10 microwatts, for stronger signals, it starts sliding into a linear characteristic. Volts in equals volts out, so to speak, with a transfer characteristic, gain number. And as such, there's ways you can calibrate it, and even if you don't calibrate it, if you just believe the data sheet from Hewlett-Packard, you're in the right ballpark. If you've got access to a known amplitude signal generator, a calibrator, a signal generator with a calibrated output, there's ways that you can now set the characteristics of your particular machine. You can put grease pencil marks on your oscilloscope screen, and each horizontal line represents a certain amount of power going in. So as you're tuning up a transmitter, and you use the crystal detector to monitor what's going on at intermediate stages, you can find out how well each individual stage is working. Even if your oscilloscope only goes up to, let's say, 1 megacycle, and you're measuring a transmitter that works at 146 megacycles, the crystal detector acting in between will allow you to find out what's going on at each one of those stages by AC coupling it, even if there's a DC voltage present on that particular portion of the circuit. You have to be a little bit careful about a crystal detector, though. There is one vulnerability. Let me drop. And that is there's a maximum power input where if you exceed it, you might create damage. And I think it's somewhere in the vicinity of a tenth of a watt, around 100 milliwatts, 200 milliwatts, is usually the maximum power tolerance of a crystal detector. Exceed that, and you might permanently damage it. Also,
Yeah.
The good news is they're extremely fast.
Yeah.
The bad news is they're electrostatic discharge, ESD sensitive. So make sure that the cables you connect to your crystal detector have been previously discharged. There's no DC voltage on them greater than 1 volt. 1 volt on a charged cable because of static pickup or whatever, and you just connect it to the crystal detector, there's a slim chance you could create damage. Putting your finger across the piece of cable to discharge it, send a conductor to ground, is the poor man's way of doing it, but make sure your cables are discharged before you make connection with the crystal detector. I probably created a few more questions on the subject, but as a power sensor, as a way of making amplitude modulation measurements, as a way of looking at rise time of digital signals, there's a whole lot of ways you can use a crystal detector. It is a poor man's power meter. There are times you can pick them up at a flea market for numbers like $5 or $50, even though their brand new price may have been closer to $1,000. And even if you get a bad one, the vast majority of them, you can completely disassemble them, and the actual crystal diode assembly inside, in the case of the Hewlett-Packard units, is usually a cartridge, which is a replaceable unit. It's a purchasable, replaceable unit. So even if you've got a bad one at the flea market, and they're selling it at a cheap price, it's still a good deal, in my opinion. Let's see if anyone, including Bill, has further questions or comments on the subject. Please give me your call letters right now. K2LIW on the TechNet.
K2KEY.
Bell recognized. Anyone else?
I have a question on another subject, which I got stepped on before and I was unable to get in here.
You're number three on the runway. Not to worry, Joe. We'll be getting to you pretty soon. Hang in there. Anyone else? Okay. Mel, I bet you've used crystal detectors a zillion times in your career. Give us a few words on that subject. You got it, Mel.
Okay. You know, I'm going to bring up right from the beginning. So I'll give you first a little laugh and then a little bit of interest in something that took place many years ago. When I was about 10 years old, I built a crystal radio. Maybe I was even younger. Maybe I was nine years old. I built got a crystal radio as a gift. Came with a pair of headphones, you know, coil, everything, and a cat's whisker. And I never had very much luck in making it work. And I envisioned that the ideal thing would be to put a crystal diode in there. And that was something I just couldn't obtain back in the late 40s and all. They still were pricey and everything. And it just so happens because a television set, there was a fire on the block where I lived, and they threw out a TV set that had burned up. And I took all the tubes out and everything, and one tube I came across was a very interesting little tube. How I figured this out at the time, I even surprised myself, was a 6AL5. I think you may remember that tube as a double diode. And I was able to put 6 volts from 4 flashlight batteries to light the filament up on it and made myself my first crystal detector stick over.
Very crafty. My recollection is a 6AL5 was a dual diode detector with remote cutoff pentode tube. I think it was a triple function tube. Two diodes and a pentode amplifier all wrapped into one tube.
Two diodes.
Only two diodes? There was no other amplifier in there, Mel? Is that what you're saying?
I think you're thinking of a 6AT6, a dual diode detector tube.
Give that man a cigar. He's right. But still, that's a very crafty idea, Mel. Too bad a 1N34. Let me think now. I first got some 1N34 inexpensive diodes in my hand, oh, I guess 1958 or so. So at least they weren't too expensive then, but you got your ham license a couple of years earlier than me, and therefore they may have been a little bit more rare in those days. Also, for those progressive guys living in the Brooklyn area, I'm amazed you didn't find some guy that had some solid-state diodes for you. I also use the cat whisker, the Galena cat whisker, the Galena crystal and the cat whisker. And the particular article we were reading out of, I think it was Popular Mechanics or Popular Electronics, probably Poppy Mechanics at the time, suggested you could make a crystal radio by having a cat whisker touching just the right point of a Gillette blue blade razor blade, and you would get a diode action. And after playing around with it for hours, we did get it to work one day and give us a nice sound into the earphones that lasted for about 3 seconds. So we eventually got a real Galena crystal. And so crystal radios are kind of fun. And you live in the metro area where you probably have some strong AM broadcast stations nearby. The one thing that's not so great about a crystal radio is it's hard to tune from one frequency to another. They tend to pick up whatever is the strongest local radio station. But it's completely free audio, if you know what I mean. For most of the crystal detectors, crystal sets, no power is required. And if you're a person that wants to put on a set of earphones and go to sleep and listen all night long, the price is right. You never have to plug the thing in. So crystal detectors, when they're rectifying the envelope of RF and giving you a video output voltage, it's called video. Call it fast-moving DC or call it DC if you like. You can plug it into earphones. You can plug it into an oscilloscope. You can plug it into a digital voltmeter. And when the whole system is properly calibrated, you know how many watts of RF or how many volts of RF is present at a particular point in your circuit because of that rectification action of the crystal diode detector. Very, very handy device. Another point I was going to make about that, but I've forgotten it right now. Let's see if anyone else has any further questions or comments about crystal detectors. And it's a subject that should be better covered. And
repeater, timeout.
From my point of view, it's a good circuit to, it's a good piece of hardware to learn about, buy if you see it at a flea market. Guarantee you'll find some way of using it downrange. Give me a call, Liz, if you've got further questions or comments. K2RIW.
M2EO.
Rich recognized. Anyone else? You've got it, Rich.
Yeah, you know, I'm on 75 meter AM, and I haven't built it yet, but it's one of the two dues on my list is to make a little crystal detector with an inline RF pickup so I can monitor the quality of the audio, because I'm using the Behringer processor with the RE20 electro voice mic, and a crystal detector makes a very, very nice way with a set of headphones, maybe an amplifier stage between the headphones and the crystal detector to monitor the outgoing audio. Very good if you're running AM. Not good if you're running sideband. You need a product detector. But for AM, it worked beautifully. Yeah, thanks.
You brought up a very good point, and that is as a signal monitor, a signal confirmation, built-in test equipment. Much of the microwave equipment that I've worked on, and many of the microwave circuits on, say, for instance, the 10-gig band and the 1-gig band that we microwavers have used, quite often, right at the output connector that goes to the transmission line, that goes to the antenna, very near that output connector, there quite often is a small, bare piece of wire, oh, maybe a quarter of an inch long, that lies parallel to the output center conductor of a coaxial cable. That in turn has one end grounded, the other end going to a crystal detector, a diode, a capacitor to ground. That in turn has a voltage going on a shielded lead to another output connector on the back panel of the instrument. Connect a digital voltmeter or some other kind of indicator, a light-emitting diode or whatever, and it is a confirmation that your microwave circuit is putting out power at this time. I mean, if you're using a tunable IF transverter system where you plug 144 megs into one port and you're expecting to get 10,000 megs out of another port that goes to an antenna to put you on the air, it gives you a warm, fuzzy feeling to know that that light is lighting up, telling you that, yes, you are putting out RF power. That's the first thing you want to know about. Are you putting out RF power? The second thing you want to know about is what frequency it's on, and the first thing you want to know about is what does it sound like. So the crystal detector can tell you at least two of those things. What does it sound like if it's amplitude modulated, and the fact that RF power is present. So there's lots of pieces of test equipment, lots of pieces of RF transmitting equipment that have a small sampling piece of wire to a crystal detector as a built-in test piece of hardware. There are many brick oscillator assemblies that have something similar, which again gives you confirmation that the whole procedure, the whole assembly is working correctly and putting out a signal. So good thing to know about. And the way they behave with weak signals and strong signals, the weak signals below minus 20 dBm, they have a square law characteristic where milliwatts in gives you millivolts of out. and then for stronger signal levels at minus 20 dBm, volts in give you some number of millivolts out, or volts out, so to speak, as they slide from the...
Repeater, timeout.
As the device slides from the square law region into the linear region. That characteristic of square law for weak signals and linear for strong signals, again, is not well covered in the books. The people who have got real hands-on experience using radio circuits in test laboratories for years pass that kind of information among themselves, and you learn these things. Very few books will tell you specific pieces of information like that. Again, it's one of these well-kept secrets. The way antennas behave and the way antennas are designed and the way they actually operate, again, falls into that category of what I call a well-kept secret. So, good set of questions you asked there, Bill. You probably have some further questions about how to use them. One of the things that Bill has run into is that the Enritsu company, among other companies, and I think also Mini Circuits, makes a crystal diode detector assembly, which has a USB port on one side and an RF input connector on the other side. They're a little bit on the pricey side, but they have an absolute power indication that you take the RF input connector, which is 50 ohm, it presents a 50 ohm load, it operates from numbers like 10 megacycles to 18 gigahertz inclusive. You connect the USB connector to your particular computer with the right piece of software on your laptop screen. It'll tell you exactly how many millivolts or how many milliwatts is present, or dBm. You can make it read out in milliwatts or dBm. It'll tell you exactly what power is present, and in some cases it'll actually display the waveform if there's amplitude modulation. So these things become an exact power indicating device, instantaneous power indicating device, and you use them because they're so darn fast. In fact, even if you had access to a $30,000 spectrum analyzer, and you also had access to a crystal detector, and if you're trying to measure the exact waveform of a exotic amplitude modulation that maybe is fast, and if you had the choice of using the $30,000 spectrum analyzer or the $5 crystal detector, the possibility exists that you'll get more accurate indication of a rapidly amplitude modulated signal by way of the crystal detector. That's kind of a paradox there. That in that particular case, unless you're very smart and know how to set...
Repeater, timeout.
Unless you're very smart and know how to set the controls just right in the so-called time domain mode of the spectrum analyzer, you might get more useful information in a shorter period of time with that inexpensive crystal detector instead of the very expensive spectrum analyzer. In your business, I bet you've occasionally run into situations like that, Bill. WB2QGZ, finally got your call letters right. K2RIW, thank you for a good question, Bill.
Thank
you. Mel recognized, but Bill first. Go ahead, Bill.
Yep, no, we made a lot of progress between today and yesterday, just running over a little bit of this. And it's pretty neat, actually. Is the typical common dynamic range for these things, or operable range, like approximately minus 40 to plus 20, is that, in other words, a 1N34, if you try to use one of those devices, is that a pretty much an average operating range? And then to Mel.
That's approximately it, Bill. If you've got a very, very sensitive video circuit that can look into the microvolts of video output, there are so-called... not vector, scalar. There's a whole series of scalar vector network analyzers. Pacific Scientific is one of the companies. I own one of these things. And they've got this exotic crystal detector assembly with a very fancy video amplifier circuit after it in a machine that looks like an oscilloscope. That scalar network analyzer will operate down to numbers like minus 50 and maybe even minus 60 dBm. Under normal circumstances, minus 40 is the easiest. Some of them will go down to minus 50. And it's a function of the actual diode itself. If the diode doing the rectification is either a so-called reverse diode, which is a kind of tunnel diode, or a diode that has what they call zero crossing characteristics because of heavy doping, There are exotic diodes that will go down to much smaller voltage amplitude. Your ordinary 1N34 diode, a germanium diode, takes more than 2/10 of a volt of forward voltage across the diode before the diode really starts conducting. Whereas there are exotic diodes that will start going into conduction at much smaller voltages. That's the good news. But then they don't go quite as high in the higher end of the dynamic range. A properly designed crystal diode detector assembly can have both diodes in there, with more than one output connector on the video side going into the actual network analyzer, the scalar analyzer. And as such, it'll look at the low-level diode for weak signals and the high-level diode for strong signals, and it knows when to switch over between the two. So there are scalar network analyzers that will give you the ability to make measurements from approximately minus 60 to plus 20, 80 dB of dynamic range. In fact, the latest version of the power meters made by Hewlett-Packard Agilent company are really no longer using a bolometer-type QRMS power sensing device. In fact, in other words, the bolometer type presents a 50-ohm load and the power repeater.
Time out.
And the power going into the detector heats that load and is a very sensitive thermistor assembly that measures the temperature and interprets that into power. Well, they have trouble getting below around minus 30, whereas the crystal diode assemblies with the right kind of circuitry can get down to numbers close to minus 60. And that's the good news. But because they have the square law-like characteristic for steady-state signals, a CW signal, they give a beautiful, accurate indication. When modulation is present or when a significant amount of noise power plus signal is present, then life gets more complicated. The square law characteristic and the way it interprets power can give you some error. Some of the later versions of the Agilent power sensors, like the HP-436, has an exotic transfer curve, what would you call it now, curve shaper assembly in the video amplifier, which creates the inverse curve of the transfer characteristic of the square law slash linear crystal diode assembly. Therefore, instantaneously, the machine knows by way of its curve tracer what real power is coming out. Therefore, depending on how you program this thing, it can give you average power, true RMS power, peak power, and so on, of a amplitude modulated signal, and it can do it fairly accurately. So there are pluses and minuses of using crystal detectors as absolute power indicators, but they've come a long way, and as I said, there are a number of very good application notes if you go to the right website of Hewlett-Packard slash Agilent on that particular subject. Let's see what further information Mel's got for us. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, a very interesting application of course, the crystal diode came during World War II, and it was very important, the development of a diode called the 1N23. I have to remember that one quite well because I had a piece of equipment that was built during World War II. That was a very interesting piece of equipment built by a company called Davin Electronics, and it based its use. Now, this was an early version of a microwave-type device for measuring microwaves up to, the way they had it marked, up to 30,000 megacycles. It was actually marked 30,000 megacycles, and it used the 1N23, which at the time was the lowest capacitance diode that you could possibly obtain, and also was almost completely free from transit time difficulty. So it was really the step forward in microwave operating and detection was that type of diode. I wonder if you remember the 1N23, Dick, over.
Oh, very well. I probably have about 15 of them in the house, 1N21 and 1N23 series. And they also have an A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, depending on the individual sensitivities of those diodes and their particular frequency characteristics. Quite a few of us use an inline, continuously indicating power meter, like a Jones micromatch or a Bird wattmeter. You take those machines apart, and quite often you will find inside a 1N21 or a 1N23 cartridge-type crystal diode detector. It looks like a small bullet, so to speak. It's got a point on one end and a flat end on the other end, and the point is, I think, the cathode, and the other end is the anode. I might have it backwards. And by the way, the majority of the crystal detectors made by Hewlett-Packard are negative indicating. That means for whatever RF power you put in, the voltage you get out is a negative voltage. They make a whole series of them that also are reverse polarity, the so-called positive series. They're more expensive, they're more rare. That's just a minor difficulty when it comes to interpreting the screen. And many in an oscilloscope will have a button you can press where it will invert the voltage before it displays it on the screen. So that's a very minor problem. But your Bird wattmeter, your Jones micromatches, and many of these other power indicating devices really contain something like a 1N21 or 1N23 diode in there. Almost every one of the World War II radars, all the way up until the probably early 60s, the mixer front end of the radar was a 1N23 diode. Local oscillator signal plus the RF signal, let me drop, were simultaneously applied to that particular diode. It did the detection, it did the mixing action that would take your 10 gigahertz radar signal, mix it down to, say, a 70 megacycle first IF, and the rest of the radar was a bunch of amplifying stages with filtering at 70 megacycles. So that simple crystal diode detector, which is called a point contact diode, if you actually X-rayed the thing or took it apart, you would find a small piece of solid-state material mounted in a small little housing, and a sharp point with a set screw assembly is connected to it, literally is a point contact, all inside of that assembly. As such, there's two things you got to be careful about. You drop it on the floor, you may very well change its characteristic, and you got to be very careful about electrostatic discharge. You scuff your fingers, your feet across the floor, a wool rug on a dry winter day, walk over and touch that crystal diode detector that's laying on the table, and there's a medium good chance you have damaged it. So be on the careful side. Remember I told you to make sure your coaxial cables are discharged before you connect to the diode. And when you're handling the diode itself, do use what's called electrostatic discharge protection procedures. Discharge you, the human being, by touching grounded equipment before you touch that diode. Be careful. And if you really want to do it correct for industrial environment, you would be wearing a wrist strap. And that wrist strap, by the way, is a conducting object on your wrist, which goes to a wire that's grounded. But it does not go to that wire directly to ground. If so, you would be an accident waiting to happen as far as electrocution is concerned. You study those wrist straps, and you'll find out that if they're designed and being used correctly, somewhere in that circuit is a half megohm or so series resistor. You want to discharge the human being, and the half megohm resistor does that very nicely. But if that human being has his left hand connecting to a 110-volt line, while his right hand has a wrist strap on it, if the half megohm resistor wasn't there, there's a chance that it's game over, and you might become electrocuted. So when you do put on a wrist strap, ask the question of whoever has put it on you. Tell me how many ohms is there between this wrist strap and earth? And if it isn't the right number of ohms, be careful. It could be lethal, even though...
Repeater, timeout.
It could be lethal, even though it looks very innocent. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LAW.
This is K2KEY. One caution with the 1N23 that you didn't mention, Vic. Yes, the pin is the anode. The base, the brass base, is the cathode. The there is that little pin inside, and in order to keep that little pin in check, and you know, to keep it at the point where to hold it sort of at that point, that little cylinder inside there is filled with a compound that contains arsenic. I had that in a bulletin. Be careful that if it opens up, you know, you break it apart, and for some reason it gets sprayed around into your face or maybe into your mouth, you'll get a shot of arsenic, Dick, over.
That's a brand new one on me. And maybe the arsenic was put in there in order to make sure that oxidation or whatever does not take place with that very delicate point contact junction. Point contact junctions have an interesting history. The diodes that we used for radar front-end detectors and mixers of World War II were point contact diodes. The very first transistor made by Shockley, Bourdain, and Bertin
at 8 o'clock.
That first transistor, if you take the photograph of that homely-looking device with what looks like a bunch of paper clips connecting to this piece of solid-state material, those were point contacts. Some of the early transistors had a point contact for the base and a point contact for the collector across the base material. And I'm trying to remember now. I think the, what was the model number of that Raytheon transistor? There was the...
C721 and CK722.
Beautiful. I own a CK721 and a CK722. And I believe those are point contact transistors in a little blue package. I acquired those way back in the late 50s, and I once put one of those inside of the meter movement of the meter out of a Hewlett-Packard, a Heathkit meter movement, the 50 microampere meter movement, after painting the plastic black so you couldn't see through what was in. I put a small penlight battery, that transistor, and the right kind of little bitty transformer, and I made an oscillator circuit that would make the meter movement move up and down continuously. The whole circuit was so efficient that on that penlight battery, it would run for a month. And so, an eye-catching device, you take a great big front panel meter movement out of a Heathkit vacuum tube voltmeter, set it on the table, nothing connected to it, and the needle is continuously moving up and down. You put that on an electrical engineer's desk in 1959, like I did. And it drives him crazy. What is going on? I remember doing that at Telephonics Corporation, and an old codger named Frank Fussell. You have to get up pretty early in the morning to put any grass under his feet, and to put anything over on him. The first thing he did is to connect a volt-ohm milliampere meter to the two terminals on the on the back of this meter movement. Had a great big long story as to what was going on and why the meter started doing that. A great big scary story. And he put a volt-ohm milliammeter on the back of it, saw that voltage was present, that power was coming out of it, and he knew that perpetual motion doesn't exist. And he said, "Hey, Nadel, you're pulling a hoax here, aren't you?" It took him about 30 seconds or maybe a minute and a half to find that one out. But before that, for a couple of hours, I had the whole engineering department going crazy. My story was that I had dropped my vacuum tube voltmeter on the ground, that the horseshoe magnet inside of the meter movement cracked, and that as such it was changing its reluctance, and so that it changed its reluctance, created a voltage on the coil, the meter would move up, then the meter would come back down, slam against the pin, it would shake the magnet again inside, and repeat the process. That was my story, a hair-raising story. And I...
Repeater, timeout.
I had a whole engineering department for half a day believing that story until somebody finally put it on Frank Fussell's desk, and he said, "No way, Jose." But those words didn't exist in 1959, but he said the equivalent, and it caught on real fast, and he said, "Boy, you guys have been sucked up." Thought you'd enjoy that story. Wonder if you ever heard that one before, Ramel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh, but I leave it up to you. I'm sure you came up with something to drive them nuts. Very cute, Dick. Yeah, there were final words on this before we go on. It's getting a little late. Is that in the amateur radio, early world of amateur radio, what became very, very popular, you may want to say a few words, was the what was known as the absorption wave meters, which were really the crystal. Those little crystal detectors really became the heart of making an absorption wave meter. And then I think we should move on, Dick. Over.
Another very good use of a crystal diode detector-like assembly. Many of us know what a grid dip meter looks like. And something that looked somewhat similar, that was very popular, I would guess from 1920 to 1960, an absorption wave meter. It really was a coil and variable capacitor with a calibrated dial on it, and depending on which coil you plugged in and which portion of the diode you looked at, you know that you were tuning it to 1 megacycle, 3.5 megacycles, 7 megacycles, and so on. So you would tune the dial with the right coil so that you created a resonant LC circuit with an exposed coil at that frequency. Bring that absorption wave meter near your transmitter, near an antenna, near a weakie,